It's, oh, it is. Well, we're actually recording. But if you don't want microphones, will we still record if we don't have a microphone? Just put it.
Hello?
Hello. Check them. Oh, good. Thank you very much all for coming tonight. There's a lot happening in the city at different galleries. The art gallery's got a huge talk, a whole bunch of things happening. So really, really appreciate this. And that you've come to St. Leonard's, which is great, which is a really active, activated precinct. Has been for a couple of years through TWT and now Bridging Hope. What we've got here is just a spool of different photos of artist Gustave Boulanger, a French artist, Warhol Factory, Frida Kahlo's studio, and of course these three artists. But firstly, I want to welcome you all again and acknowledge the Camerigal people, past, present, and future. Thank you. And it's interesting, the Camerigal, I actually called council today because I couldn't get confirmation over websites and different things. So it's really, really interesting. We're just on kind of a border of the different people. So it's very exciting. The Bridging Hope Charity Foundation, for those who don't really know it, was founded in China about 3 years ago and became very active in Australia a year ago. Tina Tian is the founder. She's not here tonight. We provide community engagement with the TWT Creative Precinct here in St. Leonard's. And for those who don't know, these several blocks will eventually be demolished. Anthony, you've come from Paris. My goodness. This is great. Thank you. To become really one of Australia's great arts precincts in building on what's already been here. Not only is Bridging Hope really helping with the local creative precinct, but we're the major foundation of the Biennale of Sydney, the principal supporter of the Big Anxiety Festival that the UNSW featured this year, and have given Lifeline significant funds for a feasibility study in Mandarin and that will hopefully happen in the next few years in Australia and China. Just so that you know, this is being taped, and it will be podcast on the Bridging Hope Charity Foundation website sometime soon. The previous talk, we won't be having a Q&A after, but the artists will stay behind for about 10 minutes, is that okay? And can answer your questions individually. I think that that's a more personal way to do it, really. You may have noticed the ping pong table on your way in. That's the common room. There's only one bat, that's so people don't play tonight. That was really, and you might have also noticed some stunning light works as you entered. They're by Ali Indermuller, who will be joining the Creative Precinct very shortly, an early career artist. Who's going to be in Vivid again this year and whose works are pretty spectacular. So it's all becoming really quite active. It's really great to see so many people in the art world and artists in this room. Thank you. This is great. As part of community engagement, we're very pleased to have offered these three rather esteemed Australian artists studios in the precinct. Caroline Studios downstairs, but don't knock on the door during the day. Abdul is just down the hall, and he was literally painting a bomb up until about 15 minutes ago. And Joan will be a few doors down up the street. And for the moment, your studio's in your living room, I think. So for those of you who don't know these three artists, Caroline Rothwell, these three artists, a lot in the art world, you don't need introductions, but Caroline Rothwell is collected by most major public institutions in Australia, internationally as well. Represented by Rosalind Oxley Nine Gallery, And I actually bought a little work of hers at her first ever show when Grant Peary was still alive. And you can talk about your process later. Joan Ross just rocks it. your video works, I have been laughing with Joan's works for decades. When Barry Kuldulis, who's the director of Sydney Contemporary, represented Joan, it was just, years ago, just a few years ago. Abdullah has so many accolades. I was going to list everybody's, but we would have been here for a very long time. Ariel and I came back from Hong Kong a few days ago, and it was extraordinary to see the international furor, basically, over Abdul's works that was selling like hotcakes to very, very major collectors. And if I may also say, due to being here, may I say, that your work was included in Abdul's gallerist in Singapore, and Caroline's work went to one of Japan's major collectors from Art Basel. So it's very exciting. So we're very proud to offer these artist studios in an offshoot of the Creative Precinct that will shortly be formally launched. This whole area of 19 buildings is going to be redeveloped in the next however many years. So stay tuned. We have very big plans for the future that have grown on everything that's been seeded here. So to start with, the title, The Mythology of the Studio, refers to the tradition of making art in a studio. And given today's really demanding competitive environment, I'll start with you, Caroline, because you're closer. I mean, the mythology of the artist in the garret, high on heroin, drunk as a skunk, can an artist survive that way today?
Be nice to try. But running a studio, I suppose I see it more as a lab. It's a place for production and experimentation. Is it a garret? No, I don't think we operate within the kind of garret system anymore. Well, I don't think possibly ever did. That. I love this image of the heroic artist Gustave Boulanger in his Parisian studio with the, kind of the whole Orientalist idea with the,
it's one of the black and white images.
With the tiger skin on the floor and, the poor kid sort of straight off the street kind of, being drawn in the, the kind of whole mythology of the kind of modernist, male at the time, male artist kind of, doing their epic paintings. We've shifted, we've moved. And I suppose, yes, we're in production. I'm making objects, but I'm pursuing ideas. The studio is all about, I see it as a kind of philosophy. I see as my mode of working is, is exploring life through these crazy things that you make. Yeah.
In different mediums.
Yeah.
And Joan, the shot that we have here of your present studio, which is your living room, which will change when you move here, but it might have the same atmosphere. Is that your take as well? Is it sort of a lab for you? Is the studio a lab? Do you work primarily in the studio?
I feel like I sort of risk my chance of keeping a studio if I'm completely honest about how I practice in the studio. I'm a really inconsistent person.
Your art isn't inconsistent.
Sorry?
Your art is consistent.
So it just depends on what I'm doing. Like, I was asked, often I get asked, can I do an interview in your studio? And I say, well, let me meet you in the park with my computer, because, sometimes that's what I'm doing. I'm sitting out in the park doing my work, or I prefer to be at home. I had a studio in the Blue Mountains in the backyard for many years, and I preferred to just go out to the studio, although my family will attest to me never leaving the house and taking over the entire house as a studio. So the picture there is a tidier version of that. I was actually looking through some photos for my son, and behind him consistently were giant handbags and underpants hanging behind him, and just the, which was an artwork. The thing for me is that when I'm in the mood for it, I do it. And so it doesn't matter where I'm standing, I'll do it.
At any time of day or night, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And often I'll stay up really late. I mean, I'm not a 9-to-5-er. I'm not consistent either, because I work to deadlines, and I'll maybe work for 9 weeks, like incredibly intensely, and then I won't work for 6 months. Mm.
That's actually not true. Abdul, is that the same for you? I mean, Abdul was painting in his studio just down the hall up until about 20 past six.
I've got a little bit of a different approach. I'm pretty systematic when I go about things. Like in the last studio I was at, my studio mate Liam would tease me because he reckons that I did most of my work on the phone. And it's true. I'll be on the phone half of the day sort of organizing things, and emails a quarter of it, and the other quarter I'll get to actually produce stuff. And like beyond the message of what we do as artists and why we make art, like having a sustainable practice, I've said it a couple of times in different contexts, but the idea is that we're sole traders in the most volatile industry on the planet, and so we're kind of surfing these waves. So I feel like the idea of that solo modernist, macho, drunk genius is kind of like dwindling. Like that for that to be successful, that relies on a whole structure, a supportive structure of people whose best interest it is to keep that person drunk. does that make sense?
To facilitate, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. like the heroism of like Picasso or Brett Whiteley or something like that. Like yeah. that. I don't know how well that would work now.
Well, I think if you look at Picasso, certainly, and Brad Whiteley's demise, I think, was, you know, premature and because of all that. But Picasso was a very determined, very organized person who had a coterie of muses who
yeah,
really
maybe
helped
maybe bad
him.
Example for drunk, but like...
But yeah,
but
of
but
yesterday.
But definitely the macho, singular, solo genius.
Yeah.
I think that what Abdul said also is important is that actually we spend half our day doing emails, organizing things, sorting out things, you know...
Don't your galleries do that for you?
Huh?
Yeah, yeah. But I think that that's also the expectation of today's world, too, is the immediacy of everything. And it's interesting, I had coffee with another artist today who is also extremely well known. And that artist, interestingly, just said, you know, we are the lowest paid professionals on the planet. As a whole, there are very high expectations put on us as people and with our output. And how can that change? And it is this kind of new professionalism that is coming up. I mean, I see all of you artists in the room who are extremely dedicated, extremely professional, and sole traders, you know, who have to look after contracts, who have to look after their studios. And I think that that's... And now in big cities like Sydney and London and New York, we're losing these creative hubs and precincts, whatever we want to call them. And it's so exciting for someone like me, who's such an advocate for artists, to see these precincts growing in a city, in a big city, and not lose you. So the studio for you, I guess, has to be close to where things are happening. There are a lot of artists like Ben Quilty who live in Robertson and have their studio there. But how do you see being in a city is important to your practice?
I reckon actually what Joan was saying earlier really, I mean, I don't know if any of you have been in Joan's car, but that but that is also Joan's studio. And
the park.
The car is Joan's studio. I think you have to be really nimble as an artist. I mean, you've talked about being sole trader and running a small business, and yeah, we are, you know, you've got to eat. Also you have to be really nimble about how and where you operate. And, you know, when I first moved to Sydney 14 years ago, there were no studios that I could afford. So basically I ended up renting a kind of 3-foot by 3-foot flea-ridden bedroom, and basically just made works in that space. So you just work according to what space you're in. I mean, I was in an amazing studio before this, but I was actually subletting from another artist, so I had all her works around me. And so I just actually made work according to that space. And now, you know, suddenly I've got this space down here that is, you know, I can suddenly see things, I can lay things out, I can actually pull out works that I haven't been working on for 3 or 4 years because they were too big to actually unwrap.
So the scale of the work is determined by the studio that you have as well.
You kind of shift your practice according to where you're existing.
Yeah.
And I think I work all the time. You know, my partner has to turn me off at 10 p.m. and says, I will not talk to you about art after 10 p.m. but I think your computer is your sketch pad too. I mean, I do a lot of my drawings in digital media, and, you know, I'm using Photoshop all the time, as well as kind of getting my hands dirty in plaster and concrete. So I think the studio has really shifted to, it can be anything, can be anywhere. It can be out in the landscape. You know, artists will always use what's available. And if there's no space available, you'll find something. But it is tough in a city like this where there is, you know, it's ridiculous at the expense of studios. And it's, you know, even if you're going to Botany and, you know, Rockdale and, you know, Ataman, it's still crazy prices. So something, I don't know, this is great, hey, this is great, but this is also temporary. It's sort of, I mean, this is
also for people like us, and I'm thinking about younger people.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a, you know, when you talk about the myth of the garret, it's not a myth when you're just straight out of art school. You know, people are having to have 4 jobs just to rent in Sydney, let alone, you know, have a studio as well. And I think if we go back to talk about what our studios were like, you know, when we were just out of art school, it's a completely different story to what happens when you start to become more professional and you can actually afford one.
So what's the ideal studio? Like, if you had an idealised...
Oh, for me, it's in my backyard.
right.
And I don't care where that is.
Right. So it's just outside your back door.
It's not a very far walk.
Yeah.
But you're not going to even get wet to go. And it's just nice and big, and it's got a kettle.
And a sink.
Yeah, I don't care about the sink.
Yeah, you don't care about the sink. And Abdul, what would be your ideal, other than the one you have now?
Oh, this is pretty great. Got good views, and the Uber Eats around here is very good. But I was recently in Chiang Mai in Thailand, and I went to Navin, I'm going to mess up his surname, Ravanchai? Doesn't matter. Navin.
We can't check.
He's an amazing artist from Chiang Mai, and he has a 4-story warehouse with a private museum attached in his apartment, and he lives between there and Japan, and that's pretty ideal for me.
Oh,
it's full of his stuff. Yeah, it's just his best of.
So, but feel free, please, to interject as a conversation, because this is really kind of a conversation. So if anybody has any comments, other artists in the room, other people who would like to, just be part of it.
I'm going to comment.
Yeah, but you comment. You can comment.
Abdul showed some photographs from that trip. And one of the things that actually attracts me to this space is the community, is this, I mean, I'm not like Joan, I'd like to have both. I'd like to have the studio at home, but I do actually like to go somewhere and to make chaos and also be able to have a community around me. I find that really, I don't want necessarily even want to talk, I just want to wave, do you know? Yeah. Just know that people are, you know, like-minded community are there. I find that really exciting about being here.
I do get that.
Yeah.
But I'm one of those people that I don't want anyone to see what I'm doing before it's finished. Ah. Not a single person. And often if people were going to do studio visits, I would hide things.
Oh, that's...
Well, and I learned to hide it well. Because otherwise people, like, they go, what's that under there? And it's like, then they think it's the best thing you ever did, and it's not. But, you know, I never like if a person even sees me do one stroke, I just don't want to be there anymore. I don't want anyone to look at me.
Well, it's interesting because from an outsider, whether art or not, people have this kind of mythologized image of the artist and its magic, that every line, every stroke, every cut is magic, and that kind of we should have agency to look at the studio. But people wouldn't go into a doctor's surgery kind of uninvited and kind of go, oh, let me see what's in your drawers. You know, what do you keep on your computer? What's in your files? It's just kind of, there's this kind of public-private domain that artists inhabit. And why, I'm just thinking aloud, why is that? Why is there this kind of, people want an in into the artist's procedures?
Because it's the lie of the genius. I think that's what it is. It's that they think that they're, yeah.
Well, they can choose not to acknowledge.
Could I ask court attention? I've got a question. Awesome.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. Does that mean that there's a danger in demystifying the artist's studio? If you don't want to see in the doctor's drawer, a cosmetic surgeon, for example, they perform something rather special, and yet nobody wants to see in their drawer. So what you're saying is...
Haven't you been watching YouTube?
Oh, that's interesting. And I, if I can introduce Anthony White, who is an Australian artist living in Paris and whose abstract works are monumental. But so do you think if we sort of, yeah, what do you think? Anthony's question.
Well, I don't believe in the genius, and I think there's a, and I actually also think that there's, I think, I don't know if many people do anymore, do they? I think it's a bit of an ambivalence around artists, actually. You know, I don't know. I think funnily enough, I used to, when I first went to art school, I was so intimidated by the whole idea of art school that I used to turn all my drawings to the wall so no one could see them. And I actually just put into my head, actually, all I'm doing, if I was a plumber, I wouldn't care. So actually, I'll just act like a plumber. And it was actually really, it was really useful for me to just think, well, actually, this is just, I'm just like an engineer, I'm just operating, and this is the way that I'm working, and you can either choose to look or not, I don't care.
Yeah, but what about the comments? You know, you love a work, and then someone's walking along, they go, oh, that's so amazing, and it's not, and it's, you know, it's, I don't welcome those sorts of comments from people.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I don't even know if I register them. Maybe, and maybe people don't say it so much.
Do you think it's because artists have always been at the forefront? We talked about Picasso before, and his painting Guernica was such a comment politically of the times, that artists have always, through the ages, the Venus of Willendorf, you know, when you start an art history, commented on the day, and people seek kind of answers to questions that they have. Abdul?
Oh, I think that through our work we can articulate things in a, like I've talked about, I'm like having a similar function to a journalist, but without being burdened by objectivity. Like it can be as subjective and reactive and responsive and emotional as we want. To go back to what we were talking about before, I suppose I don't mind people coming to the studio, but I agree with the comments. Like my partner, she's currently banned from the studio. that ban will be lifted at some point. But like, it depends on where it's coming from, and often it'll just sort of bounce off. But there are a few key people that I really take to heart what they say, and so it can matter. And also depending on what stage in the process. Like for instance, if I'm doing a photo shoot, I really don't like anyone else who's not directly involved in the photo shoot to be there, because I can find that can be difficult. But if I'm painting and underpainting, where I'm just sort of being quite mechanical about the process, the room could be full of people and it doesn't matter.
Right.
So it kind of depends on the situation.
Yeah, yeah. Do you feel the same way?
I don't like people being around when I work. I mean, my mother says she's never, no one ever even believes I do make the work because no one's ever seen me do it.
It is interesting because, I mean, I grew up with a mother who wasn't a terribly good artist, but an artist nonetheless, and every time they moved, she took her studio accoutrements with her. And it was kind of her place. And I think in the world that, you know, we've always inhabited, and now especially, it's so important to have that sense of place. And
oh yeah, definitely. Like to, I find my space, it's hard to describe to someone who doesn't have a studio-based practice or like that type of creative practice, but I could be in the studio like all day and all night, and it's fine, and I love it. It's the happiest, that's my happy place.
Yeah.
And I also, as much as I don't mind people coming in and talking to me, the idea of someone going in there without my permission or going in there and looking through my stuff, it would feel like a violation. So it's, yeah, very much about, that's a place where I've got complete agency and self-determination in that squared off spot. But at the same time, when we're talking about community, I love it. Like when I first moved to Sydney 3 years ago, went to Birmingham Street Studios and was there for 3 years, and there was 22 artists there. Everyone was full time, and everyone sort of understood personal space and like the idea of when to work and when it's all right to chat, and we had a really good sort of system. Unfortunately, now that's going to be a furniture shop, that building. Mm. But so we're all kind of spread out. But yeah, that the idea of building up, like I'm talking all over the place. I do a lot of talks in schools.
Yeah.
Usually a little bit more succinctly, but then when I do a talk in schools,
all over the place.
And I want to give advice to people that have just left art school or are thinking about pursuing art, I think the first thing that they need to do is find a community. And if they can't find a community, they should start building one. And then when they build a community, then share opportunities, share ideas, share practices, share skills, all sorts of things. And people.
And not be scared about sharing.
Yeah, and people come up together.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I've got a real big bias against Melbourne. I lived there for a few years, but I found people, every opportunity I'll talk about. But
three times in the last month, and every time you speak about how bad Melbourne is.
Yeah, true. But I found people were really protective and held things closer to their chest. Well, when I moved to Sydney, it was the artists that I met first that were really sort of open, and it was a very different experience. So I won't go into too details again. But like, yeah, that sort of, that openness I really like.
But I think it's like that with anything, isn't it? It's just, yeah, it's so, I think maybe for, I'm looking at the room, and maybe not everybody knows exactly what your practice involves as far as materials. So maybe if you can talk about briefly what your practice is, and then each of you, and this kind of studio requirements for that.
Okay. So actually, my dad was an industrial chemist, so I grew up melting lead and mixing things and blowing things up, and I basically, don't listen to this, do you? But I basically kind of continued that practice throughout my studio practice, where I've, you know, I mean, dad had these 17th century organ pipes that just were taking up too much space in the lounge room, so he was getting rid of them, so I decided to melt them down, and you know, the only thing I could think to pour them into were some old pillowcases that Mum had. So, you know, I kind of always sort of been interested in materials and the meaning of materials, and with it, so my practice is really, I think, quite art science based. So I do anything from, you know, collecting emissions out of the back of car exhausts and making paintings with those.
Beautiful paintings.
You know, maybe talk about endangered species, and you know, it's kind of playful. It's playfully political, I suppose.
And Caroline, I think I'm sorry if I didn't go through a lengthy CV of each of the artists, but Caroline's work, one of her sculptures, is presently on the rooftop of the MCA.
Yeah, that's it's a big renewable energy turbine. We're actually having a few issues with the renewable energy part of it, which is very
ironic,
which is very contemporary.
What endangered animals did you make?
Oh, and well, the endangered animals, the thing that really interests me is doing the ones that no one actually ever considers. So things like the Tasmanian torrent midge and the dinosaur ant, and you know, these little things that I've never seen. And I'm, you know, because we're living in a colonized space, and I'm, you know, come from England via New Zealand through Irish heritage, you know, I'm part of a trajectory that, and I come to this land knowing nothing. You know, I moved here 14 years ago and I'm ignorant. So I was really interested, when I first got here, I started looking at a lot of history paintings and was really interested in the failure to see the landscape. So, you know, when people drew the gum trees and the Tasmanian tigers and that thing, they drew them, Tasmanian tigers look like cats and dogs. I'm talking about the Europeans, you know, and the trees look like elm trees and oak trees. So I, when I started looking at these little endangered things, I just look at them from 72 DPI imagery on the computer screen, and then I translate them as failures, knowing that they're not ever gonna, you know, because I'm recognizing my failure as a scientist and my failure as a kind of, as an illustrator. I'm not interested in being a natural history painter. I'm more interested in the politics of that act. Mm-hmm. So I intentionally fail with these works. So they're all, they look like natural history paint. In fact, I think there might be the odd one up on, Anne Zahalka did this beautiful shot of the studio.
With the table and the drawings.
And anyway, yes, yeah, so there's a shot up there. So I was using, you know, they're all insects. I'm very interested. Yeah, there I am.
There you are. Oh, that's you. You plucked your eyebrows. And Joan, you know.
Anyway.
Thank you. Thank you. Joan's works. This is the what's. And that was the work that just went to Hong Kong. No.
No.
And Joan, with your work, I guess that you're characterized as an exceptional humorist, looking at or humorously looking at a very unhumorous world, and particularly with colonialization, using video and found objects.
I don't try to make it funny.
You just are.
Well, you know, I don't. Once I tried to make a funny painting, and I couldn't. So, if you ever want to be funny, just be yourself.
Just
that's
be
what I say.
Yeah.
Did no one think? It's true. I'm looking here at Leanne. And Leanne and I went to art school together. And I remember, you know, we had studio spaces. And one of the things that is really strong for me is that all the people that became really successful were people who stayed back in their studios and used their studios really well when they were at art school. And because I would often be there with just two or three people, you know, until it closed.
It's focus, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what, I mean, you know, studios offer you that opportunity to do that. I mean, in the art schools at the moment, when I was teaching, there was a push to actually not allow people permanent studios, to make the studios smaller. And I just think all of that is really is going to disadvantage everyone, because I think that, you know, when you talk about what's the perfect studio, and that's a room like this with, you know, a nice high roof and...
outside your back door.
Yeah. But, you know, it's a big space, and it's somewhere that you can, like, experiment and, I mean, I work in every medium and I need to be able to find the place to do that. And I think that, like I said, art schools are pushing towards smaller spaces and not being able to keep your painting up overnight or your sculpture.
Is that because of available space?
Yeah, I think it's...
unavailable space.
Yeah, I think it's a furphy. I think it's bad management in an art school to do that. And I think that people will be much more successful if they can continue to have spaces to work in.
And which it's cost that makes it very difficult. We're actually, without letting any cats out of bags here, but we're working with UNSW Art and Design to do some sort of residencies and international exchanges, which is so important, and particularly...
I also think that, for example, with people who, you know, that they're, you know, that people who come straight out of art school need to, like Abdul was saying, consider immediately moving into studios with other people and just starting it straight away, because actually it's quite you become quite lost when you immediately walk out of art school.
Mm. And you've had the studio there, albeit small and temporary.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Is that, yeah. And with the mediums that you practice in, You know, you have said that you don't really need a studio that much.
Well, you know, actually, I do a lot of prints, and I hand all the, if anyone knows my practice, all the fluoro on the prints is hand painted, which occasionally is like, why did I do it like this? But my, so for actually quite a number of years, my framer lets me go into his studio. Huh. He clears a space, and I just paint my work in the studio, whether it's to be framed by him or not, it doesn't matter.
Right, right.
So he's been very generous to me in that way. So that's one way I've dealt with not having a steady studio space.
And it's amazing that somebody like you hasn't had a steady studio space.
Yeah, sort of.
Yeah. and Abdul, it's interesting because the conversation that we had earlier today was just about you now being able to expand your scale and even come into, sorry, Ariel, into the common areas and maybe temporarily, like in art schools, just put a work up and start working on it. And, you know, because none of this is precious, that it can splatter paint anywhere.
Oh, yeah, coming into this space here to produce larger paintings, I think is going to be fantastic. And space is something, like I'm from Perth originally and moved to Sydney 3 years ago. I took it for granted, the amount of space that you get in Perth, and also how cheap rent was. Like if you wanted a studio, you'd pay an extra $50 or $30 a week on your rent and just get a house with another room in it. Like it was a lot. Like when I moved out when I was 17 and my rent in the share house was $30 a week, like it was... It was a while ago now, but it was much more affordable. Well, my brother lives on a dairy farm in WA, and he's got like 100 square meter shed for his studio space. It's unbelievable. But Sydney, it's a real pinch.
But does he mind, say, not being part of the whole scene in Sydney, of going to openings, of being part of that? Does that affect him?
I think it does. I think it's difficult. And one of the reasons I moved away from Perth was I felt that I was a FIFO worker flying in and out between Sydney and Melbourne where all the stuff seemed to be happening. But my brother and I, one of the fortunate things about us is that we work as a team. So having me here advocating for him or keeping him in the loop with whatever's happening, like we'll talk for like half an hour a day on the phone. Like we talk today, we hadn't spoke for a bit, so we spoke for 2 hours on the phone today. And that's just...
Wow.
Like a constant thing.
With your earphones on.
Yeah, so yeah. Bluetooth is the best.
Yeah, but that's part of your community too, your
totally.
Creative community.
Yeah. And he's my number one sounding board. I'm his number one sounding board.
So he's allowed in your studio.
Yeah, anytime.
Yeah. Now, I just, you know, we did say that there's no Q&As because sometimes it kind of degenerates into other things, but if somebody does want to make a comment, make a question, why are you giggling? Please do.